welcome to the Sacred Series Reflection. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and we'll be looking back today on the 8 episodes of this series with a really fascinating range of guests. And I do this because when I'm in the moment, I'm having a conversation with someone, I'm so focused on listening deeply to them that I sometimes don't see the themes that are emerging in those conversations and indeed across the whole series. So I love really being able to sit down and think, right, what have we learned and what have we heard? And in terms of sacred values, we've heard people say things that come up a lot, these deep things that tend to get surfaced when you ask someone to reflect on what's sacred to them. Truth, Jonathan Haidt said. Kindness, curiosity, Greg Wise said. The singularity of each being, Clementine said. Life from Chris Packham, solitude from Catherine May, beauty from Freddie Sayers, and fairness twice from Elizabeth and Sunder. And someone asked me in a different podcast interview recently, you know, what someone said to me as their sacred value that I thought was really original and insightful. And my response was, the point is the repetition. The point is to help us hear the things we have in common and the places that we diverge. That actually these deepest things, these truest things maybe are not sexy or novel or original in that way. They stay, they are steady, and they're continually calling us, I think, if we want to live intentional lives, to stay loyal to them, to keep coming back to them, to keep recommitting to these values, these ways that we want to live and not actually allow ourselves to get too distracted from them. And I also ask that question because it's generative. It's both for me. I'm curious, but I'm curious about everything about the person, and that's just way in. I ask it because it often feels like it allows a different kind of thinking in the guests, a different sort of reflection that they don't often get. They certainly don't usually get on your standard podcast. But I'm intrigued about this question, particularly at the moment, because we're going to take a break from it. Our next series, we are going to do a special one-off themed series around the book that I have coming out later this year, which is called Fully Alive. I make the sacred with Theos, but with one of my other hats on, I do writing around this theme of fully aliveness. And we're going to bring those two things together in a sort of collab and see what emerges. And so I'll be asking people, what does fully aliveness mean for them? I will, of course, still be digging for their values because I don't know how not to do that. And also because for me, you know, fully aliveness is so connected to, are we living the kind of lives we hope to live? And importantly, are we becoming the kind of people we hope we would become? Are we becoming the kind of people that we hope we will be when we die, when people stand up at our funeral and try to take 5 minutes to sum up our life, right? This incredibly stark, confronting question. Are we becoming the kind of person that we want someone to be able to talk about at our funeral? And what is sacred to you? What does fully aliveness mean to you? All of these are questions that are just trying to give us space to get to depth. But I wonder, when I come back after the next series and I'm again asking people what is sacred to you, whether it will feel like it's changed, whether it will feel like the quality of it has changed. Something that I'm aware of is that when I first started asking it in 2017, it wasn't a particularly familiar word. People might have heard of the Sacred Heart if they had sort of some awareness of Catholicism. They might have used the phrase sacred music if they were in the classical world. They might know the phrase kind of sacred places as a way of thinking about geography and space. But it was still quite an unusual word. I haven't gone and done the Google Ngram on this because I wonder if it's too recent. But my instinct is it's moved from quite an unfamiliar word to one that is more in common parlance. I wrote early doors that I liked it because it had not yet been co-opted by the, and I, this does sound mean, I don't, you know, by what I call the wellness industrial complex, you know, that it had not yet been put on loads of brands of candles. I think there's quite a lot more sacred candles now and ways of people thinking about their spirituality in sort of shallow ways, but also in deep ways about what is sacred to them. It's become slightly more mainstreamed as a word, would be my guess. And I'm interested in that and whether that makes it easier for people to use it as a way to reflect or harder. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. The themes coming through this series, trauma, I think, hardship and struggle and the ways they form us. We had, particularly in the first half of the series, I think, a very noticeably high level of vulnerability from our guests. Greg Wise, who most people probably know as an actor, talking about being present with his mum as she died. Chris Packham, who has written this very honest and exposing memoir, but is known by most people for talking about, you know, bird. That same week he was in the Times, the Times talking about birdsong, you know, is known for being quite sort of subject focused around wildlife and nature and the environment. Being so open about his childhood and grief and bullying. Clementine Morrigan, right? Childhood abuse, loneliness, the way addiction and life spinning out of control so often come from pain in your childhood. Such an important, salutary, challenging story to hear. And other guests in other ways coming as their whole selves and being vulnerable about their stories, which I am so grateful for and honored by. To be trusted with that, because it's not a given in this information environment that wouldn't just be kind of ripped into a salacious headline or made into grabby content. And it made me realize again and again how powerful vulnerability is for helping us see each other as fully human. How much when someone comes undefended, we are invited to meet them undefended. Whereas when someone comes defensive or even prickly or guarded or, scrappy, we meet that. We are hypersocial creatures. We are relational in our bones. You know, we are made in the image of a Trinitarian God in the theological phase. However you choose to describe this deep interconnection, this deep interrelatedness of us, we are continually responding to each other's cues. And vulnerability is one of those cues that helps settle us, right? Helps us stay curious and stay empathetic and see the person in front of us that we're trying to listen to or converse with or be on a team with. Gives our kind of perceptions time to allow themselves to become their fully complicated, precious, fragile, foolish human selves in their unapologetic particularity. Whereas when people come defended and defensive, we meet them as defended and defensive, right? There are these virtuous cycles of our ability to see each other as fully human. And there are these vicious cycles where we are kicked into fight or flight. The bits of our brain that are empathetic and curious shut down. The bits of our brain that are risk averse and looking for safety and for people like us kick in, and they're in control. And it makes me realize how much this project has changed me. How much the muscle, the spiritual practice of continually making myself start with that very vulnerable conversation about someone's childhood and then listen to them and their life story and as much as they're willing to share continually undercuts my tendency to be judgy and prejudiced and tribal and self-righteous. And to be clear, there is still a very large dollop of those things within my soul. But how much unconsciously, I think, my sacred value of relationships, I have enacted that value in this practice. Because our values are just ideas, right? They're just nice sounding words. You could be someone who would say to me that my sacred value is equality and never make any decisions in your life that reflect that. You could be someone whose sacred value is fairness and lives unfairly towards other people. So I think what I'm going away with and the very gentle challenge I'd like to leave with you is, if you kind of know what your sacred value is, what are the practices that you are embedding in your life with intention and seriousness to help you grow towards that thing and not away from it? Because the world will fight you. All the other competing values will fight you. Distraction will fight you. None of this comes easy. So what can you be doing to be moving towards the kind of person that you want to be, the way you hope to be described when you die? Wow, this got really heavy, but important, I think. I was left with a couple of things really lingering from this series. One was how delightful Elizabeth Ulker is in her just ease in her own skin. And how I want that. One was how Jonathan Haidt's work around the anxious generation and the underprotection of young people in online spaces might actually really affect the next generation of values, and how when you've got this incredibly, this generation being raised less strongly rooted in what sociologists might call morally formative communities, right? That I think the reason I ask people about their childhood and their family is that a lot of our values formation happens then, and we can be reacting against how we're raised as well. It can clarify that our values are not in line with the community that we are raised in. But something about the sort of ambient values of where we are raised shapes our whole worldview. But when you have a generation for whom at quite an early age, their dominant imaginative space has not really been so much in their family or their school or even their physical friendship group, but in these very fractured and I think distorting online spaces, can values formation happen? One of the arguments that Jonathan makes is that the reason these particular types of technology are so harmful for young people is that it's exactly in the window that where they're basically learning how to be a person, how they're learning to be in social settings, when they're learning to be part of a community. And in physical spaces, you learn that because you join things that are high barriers to entry, like a school or a family or a club. And those things also have high barriers to exit. You can't easily leave your school. You can't easily leave your family. It's quite a big deal to like just walk away from Scouts on the smallest thing, right? Someone's going to ask you what happened. They're going to check in with your parents. And what those high barriers to entry and exit communities do is they force you to work stuff through. They force you to disagree and then repair. You know, they force you to navigate other people being real in the world and the fact that you are not the only real person in the world. And you have to listen to them and take account of their preferences as well and learn to negotiate and become a grown-up. But that when young people are primarily functioning in places that have low barrier to entry and low barrier to exit, you don't have to do any of that. You can just leave. You can just seek a space that more perfectly is tailored to your preferences and won't challenge you and won't ask questions of you and won't require you to grow in any fashion. And so I wonder if you can learn deep values in low barrier to entry and low barrier to exit places, or if actually part of the unmooring of those technologies is it will be much more difficult for that generation to know what they think about what a good life is and what is the kind of person they want to be becoming. And so I'm so grateful for his work and the sense that there's a tipping point around our awareness of those harms, particularly as a parent. And then Freddie, I had a really lovely conversation with, and I said earlier about not wanting to just rip people's vulnerability, make it into content, right? To treat the people in front of us with as much dignity and humanity as we can muster. And as some of you know, The Sacred is on social media. We're on Instagram because we're continually trying to say, here's this quite nuanced, subtle project and get it in front of more listeners. But when you take a 60-second section out of someone's interview and make it into a reel on Instagram, which is a short video for those of you who are not on there, it can't help but be, you know, decontextualized, part of the context collapse that is one of the wider trends in our information environment. And I had a really interesting experience talking to Freddie, because often someone will have come to a different decision for me and I can see how it's because they started from a different set of values. And I can sort of go, okay, I can see how you got there if you started there. I still don't agree with you, but it makes more sense to me now. When I asked Freddie about his different decision that he had reached for me on lockdowns, he said basically my exact values back to me. Interconnection, relationship, the need for human beings together, be together, how easy it is for us to fear each other when we're separated. And that was really interesting, right? That was very challenging to realize someone can reach a different decision from the same values, and how again and again, this kind of ability to see myself as an oracle, reaching perfect decisions, you know, with full knowledge, collapses. It forces epistemic humility out of me, which all the great wisdom paths call us to, right? Humility. Do not think too highly of yourself. Do not believe that you are the one that knows the answers, because the likelihood is that you don't. But anyway, we took a piece out of Freddie's interview and put it on Instagram. And it was that quite grabby piece about, you know, because he was the one I wanted to talk about. He said, let me give you my killer stat, which we went away and checked, and is from the ONS and is a credible statistic. And the comments on it were, as expected, you know, a lot of people raising concerns who had maybe been bereaved in the pandemic, who had been clinically vulnerable, who responded as if Freddie had said, I didn't care if anyone died. I didn't care if old people died, you know. It reminded me of one of those situations where someone might be trying to express a really sensitive pro-choice position and someone says, you just want to kill babies. And how hard it is to hear each other, how hard it is to really hear what someone's saying when we are in that defended posture, right? When we are triggered into fight or flight, when we are expecting to disagree with them because they are not like us. How hard it is to really listen. And I have, you know, a lot of understanding for why that happens and how it happens. And some of those responses were really valid, right? They were really challenging and right. And actually everyone was polite, and I was really grateful for that. But yes, how you take this longer form of listening and put it in spaces designed to collapse the context and just give you the grabbiest piece. We're working out. I don't know if we're always getting it right. I'd be really interested in your thoughts on that as well. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode and this whole series of The Sacred. If you've managed to, and no shame if you haven't, if you're your first one, great. We're really, really glad you're here. We are going to be taking a break over the summer, and we will be back, not over the summer, not the whole summer. We'll be taking a little break. We'll be back a bit later in the spring. And I really enjoy having you in conversation with me. So please do get in touch, social media, email, however you can find a way. Carrier pigeon, it's all good. But until then, we'll speak to you next time.